I'm speaking with Danny Roderick, who is the Rafiq Hariri Professor of International Political Economy at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He's the author of the new book, The Globalization Paradox, Democracy and the Future of World Economy. His other books include One Economics, Many Recipes, Globalizations, Institutions and Economic Growth, In Search of Prosperity, Analytic Narratives on Economic Growth, Making Openness Work, The New Global Economy and the Developing Countries, and Has Globalization Gone Too Far? Welcome to Background Briefing, Danny Roderick.
Nice to be here with you.
And clearly you have studied globalization. Now, that's an understatement. But we seem to be in a political environment here in the United States following what's going on in Wisconsin and what is about to happen in Ohio, Indiana, and in New Jersey. Much of the arguments between public sector workers versus private sector workers and the idea that public sector workers are being scapegoated for getting it too good and private sector workers are somehow being encouraged to be bitter towards their co-workers. If I'm correct in detecting this, then aren't we in a race to the bottom here?
That's always one of the concerns in this globalization debate, which in many ways, of course, is the marking issue of our day. Sometimes the answer to that question is yes. For example, in the area of corporate taxation, there's clearly been a race to the bottom where under pressure from multinational companies and internationally mobile global capital, countries all around the world have had to reduce their corporate taxes, which means they have less money to pay for social services and other important needs. In other areas, and I think actually labor market policies and institutions, in some respects the answer is yes. In others, it's not. I think we have, different countries have responded more robustly than others. Some countries in Northern Europe have been able to maintain their distinctive labor market arrangements and protect workers, and others have let go. So, one of the points that I emphasize in the book is that national governments still have a lot of strength, and they can redress the balance between markets and public action when it goes too much in one direction.
Well, Danny Roderick, when you mention some of the Northern European countries, I think you can make a pretty clear case that countries like the Scandinavian countries, Australia, New Zealand, Canada right next door, all of the indexes that the UN does in terms of standard of living, quality of life, etc., indicate that they have a much better deal. And the most robust economy in the world today seems to be Germany. So why aren't we more aware of these comparisons? Or do you think it's a case that smaller countries are more manageable than the United States?
I think smaller countries that are more homogeneous are in fact more manageable. I think one of the important sources of strength in the United States is that it's much more diverse, more heterogeneous, larger, and in many ways much more open to the external world and external influences. But of course, that does mean that certain things that are possible in more homogeneous countries may not be possible here. I think the whole debate on sort of what's going on outside our borders gets entangled with political agendas too often, and people will hijack parts of the reality for their own purposes. Before the current financial crisis, we heard so much about the importance of competing in the global economy by reducing our taxes, and look at how well Ireland was doing because their taxes are so low. And of course, we know Ireland has turned out to be a nightmare after all. We don't hear that much about the success of Ireland. I think there are some lessons that one can take across borders and others that aren't. And I think economists have an important role to play here in terms of providing the fuller picture, which I hope I do in the book.
Well, indeed, I think the central question that you bring up is democracy compatible with globalism, in as much as we're expected to have less democracy and more globalism. And I wonder where this all began. And because you have to admit that the shift has been enormous in the last few decades. And while it has benefited countries like China and India, I don't believe that the people who came up with this scheme, if that's the right word for it, were necessarily interested in helping the lives and standard of living of the Chinese and the Indians. I think, weren't they more focused on finding cheaper labor elsewhere? And it seems that the people who lost out are all of those, you know, the downsized and the outsourced Americans who are out of work.
I think that's right. I think something very fundamental happened sometime in the beginning in the early 1980s when there was a drastic shift of minds about the balance between markets and the state, the markets and government, and the nation state versus the global economy. And partly because the earlier period of the 60s and 70s had for the most part been actually quite successful in the sense of, most boats rising along with the tide and quite a bit of rise in living standards alongside with rise in world trade and investment. We thought that we could take that one step further and simply start effectively pushing for globalization for its own sake, as opposed to as an instrument for domestic prosperity. And I think we began in the 1980s to get our priorities wrong, and it became what can you do for global markets as opposed to what can global markets do for us, lost the balance between markets and nation state, and certainly many people and many countries have actually benefited. You mentioned China and India. It's interesting that they actually played the whole globalization role by the earlier rules rather than new rules, because as they were benefiting from globalization, they were actually doing a lot of things domestically, which aren't in the rules in the sense of preventing capital from coming in, letting their exchange rate, manipulating their exchange rates, having trade and industrial policies that wouldn't fly by the rules of the World Trade Organization and so forth. So the countries that have been successful in this most recent era, paradoxically, are the ones that have played by the older rules rather than the new ones.
Again, I'm speaking with Danny Roderick, who's the author of the new book, The Globalization Paradox, Democracy and the Future of the World Economy. Well, without being cynical, Danny, it seems to me that globalization in many ways has been used as a kind of an excuse to tear up what little social contracts we have here. You know, we only basically, the Europeans and Australia and New Zealand and other democracies that have a higher standard of living, including Canada next door, the people seem to vote in terms of voting for politicians who are stewards of their tax money, which in turn comes back to them in the form of government services. And we get very, very few government services, and the ones that we get, Social Security and Medicare, are now under assault from the political right in this country. And yet we don't seem to be able to recognize how countries that have maintained their social contracts have prospered. We're continually told that the Swedes commit suicide, the French have terrible health care, and the Canadians are all complaining about their health care, etc. So where does all of this propaganda come from? Because the thing that I see really clearly is that we are, I think all of us are in a race to the bottom. At the same time, there is a new global elite that's emerged who are a sort of international group of billionaires who transcend borders.
I think that's right. And I think actually for too long that elite has been telling themselves and others that they don't need governments anymore. We found out in the last financial crisis that when push comes to shove, they have no one else to turn to but their own governments, whether it's Washington or the capitals in Europe. And they were bailed out by not international institutions or global markets, but by Washington when they were getting bankrupt. It's the governments that stepped in to help them. So we learned that despite whatever they may say, that they are too, at the end of the day, beholden to their governments. And in return, they have an obligation to the society that is paying the taxes that that helps them in their day of need. And I think that social contract that, that corporations and financial firms and the wealthier people, those who have the skills that can, you know, travel around the world, they have some responsibility for the rest of society as well. And that has disappeared. The sense of that has disappeared. I think the facts are actually quite clear that historically the most successful open economies, the societies that have most globalized and most successfully globalized in an economic way, are actually those societies where governments have played a very strong role in providing for social policies and social safety nets. So the open economy and strong social policies are actually two sides of the same coin. And I think that the danger in a place like this is that we try pushing for openness and hope everything will be okay, where the government doesn't fulfill its side of the bargain because it's too much under the influence of a particular narrative that emanates from large corporations and the professional classes.
And again, Danny Roderick, author of The Globalization Paradox, Democracy and the Future of the World Economy. The Germans, for example, who have a very robust economy now, particularly compared to ours, they, for example, on the boards of directors of German companies, labor sits on the board of directors. Here we're witnessing in Wisconsin an effort to extinguish labor, at least the labor that supports public employees, and that's the biggest part of the labor movement. And, of course, by extension, they support the Democratic Party, which may well be an agenda on the part of the right to defund the Democrats. So we seem to be in another universe to most of the world, particularly the successful part of the world.
Yes, I mean, one of the lessons from the recent performance of Germany is actually that even in an environment where you've given labor so much voice, that you can become hyper-competitive in world markets. It's interesting that labor costs in Germany have fallen in recent years compared to other European Union members, and that has made the German export machine that much more powerful and has made the economy more robust. And the workers are benefiting at this point, too, compared to certainly what's happening in the rest of Europe. So one of the important lesson is that if you have that kind of social accord, that kind of social contract, sense that everybody is in it together, you can get the labor movement to make the necessary concessions too when the time comes, ultimately to their own benefits.
Again, I'm speaking with Danny Roderick, author of the new book, The Globalization Paradox, Democracy and the Future of the World Economy. Now, in terms of the neoliberal model that the U.S. has developed and tried to export, again, just doing a reality check here, it seems to me that if you look at all the successful emerging economies like Brazil, China, the Asian Tigers, Japan before that, they all adopted a state-private model. The only people who followed the American example have largely been Mexico, and Mexico is a disaster. So am I being fair in suggesting that the evidence is out there that neoliberalism and globalism, our version of it, is the one that's not working?
I think that's right, and I think that's been clearly one of the lessons of the last 2.5 decades. As in everything else, I think it's a question of balance. You can go too much in one direction, close up your economy, turn into a Myanmar, and your economy goes to hell. On the other hand, if you do as Mexico did, packages open up on all fronts and simply expect that economic development will follow from that, and all you need to do is just step back, then you get a huge disappointment, as the Mexicans have found out. I think, as you say, the successful countries have been those with concerted public government strategies of working alongside markets, not against market, but providing the leadership and the kind of public-private partnerships that's required for successful growth and successful structural transformation. Every country has to find that balance for its own sake. But certainly, the neoliberal model that just said just open up your economy to the world and just step back and watch a miracle happen, that simply hasn't happened anywhere.
And I would suggest, Danny Roderick, the fact that Mexico has produced one of the world's richest men, Carlos Slim Alou, sort of doesn't that, isn't the proof there in the pudding? I mean, the idea that you've got this poor country with one of the worst distributions of wealth in the world, and yet it's produced one of the world's richest men?
That's another paradoxical lesson, because the part of the implicit political agenda of the neoliberal economic model among at least sort of well-meaning people was the argument that moving away from a state-led model would undermine corrupt cronyistic relationships that gave rise to the sort of wealthy families, sort of protected companies and so forth. And what we've learned, and of course the example of Carlos Slim you're giving is very interesting. What we've learned is that you can generate the same kind of cronyistic links during the process of turning towards the market and privatizing the economy, which is effectively what happened in Mexico. So once again, it turns out that the neoliberal model was not the magic bullet, neither on the economic growth and development front, nor on the corruption and cronyism front.
And Danny Roderick, given that China, as we mentioned earlier, and India have benefited from globalism, nevertheless, as they've raised the standard of living of their people, particularly in the case of China, the distribution of wealth is also as polarized, and I believe China is even worse than the United States, where the disparity between the richest Americans and the vast majority of Americans has grown to obscenely. But I believe in China it's even worse, and we've just witnessed these revolutions in countries like Egypt and throughout the Middle East, where there was always an assumption that it would always be this way and that somehow these people didn't want democracy. Well, that myth has been exploded. But you see the oligarchical control of the few families. And I'm curious as to know why China is heading in that direction and whether there's going to be a backlash.
That's a real concern. It's a real possibility. One of the lessons from Tunisia and Egypt and everything else that's happening in the Middle East is that even when you are moderately successful at distributing the benefits of economic growth, which was the case in Tunisia certainly, with one of the world's most rapid improvements in developmental indicators in terms of health, education, and not just incomes, is that it's not going to be enough if you don't give people a sense of voice and participation, and if you don't convince them that the government is accountable and not corrupt. And I think people, certainly in Tunisia, also to a large extent in Egypt, were revolting against their lack of voice, against the weakness of political institutions and that had not kept up with economic changes. And that's a real big threat for China, because the gamble for the Chinese government has long been that if they keep the economy growing at 8-9% a year, they generate enough jobs, and people will be happy to eat up the economic benefits and keep quiet on the political front. And ultimately, that's I think a self-defeating game. It's no wonder that the government has, if China, you try to, do a search on the Jasmine Revolution, or more recently on Cairo in Egypt, that the search engine would return blank, because they just don't want you to find out about such things. It shows how concerned they are. Now, I don't think China has in many ways stronger governance structures than any of these countries. So we should be careful before we draw very straightforward conclusions. But ultimately, it is clear that China will have to reform its political institutions to provide the kind of more accountable, democratic institutions that a rapidly developing economy requires. Because ultimately, if your political institutions don't catch up with your economic development, either economic development goes by the wayside, or you get political instability and the kind of revolts that we've seen.
Again, I'm speaking with Danny Roderick, author of the new book, The Globalization Paradox, Democracy and the Future of the World Economy. So could you then make the argument that the real good, the only, at least to my mind, the only great benefit we've gotten from globalism, given that much of our industrial base has been eviscerated, and we've got an enormous unemployment at the moment as a result of recklessness on Wall Street, where we exported toxic assets and caused a global recession. The one good piece of good news, it seems to me, is the globalization of information.
Yes, and I would add actually the globalization of democracy as a global norm. I think sort of the way in which you run your economy, the way in which you regulate your financial industries, the way in which you regulate your labor markets, your health and safety laws, all of that that depends on local circumstances and preferences of voters around the world. But there's one thing that's really universal, and that's the demand for democracy, demand for human dignity and participation in making the decisions that affect their lives. And I think that's been actually the most significant force in a globalizing force in our life that's worked for the better, that no country, not even China today, can legitimately turn around and say no, democracy isn't for us. That's just a Western European construct or an American construct, and we're different. So I think that the globalization of that norm, the norm of human rights and democracy, I think that's been extremely important.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today and talking with us here, Danny Roderick. And thank you for your book, too, The Globalization Paradox.
You're very welcome. Nice to talk to you.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Danny Roderick, who is the Rafiq Hariri Professor of International Political Economy at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He's the author of the new book, The Globalization Paradox, Democracy and the Future of the World Economy.